Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Part 1, Chapter 5. Covering the story, a glimpse of the press in action, ugliness and failure. The racers were ready at dawn, fine sunrise over the desert, very tense. But the race didn't start until 9, so we had to kill about 3 hours in the casino next to the pits, and that's where the trouble started. The bar opened at 7. There was also a coffee and donut canteen in the bunker, but those of us who had been up all night in places like the Circus Circus were in no mood for coffee and donuts. We wanted strong drink. Our tempers were ugly, and there were at least 200 of us, so they opened the bar early. By 8:30, there were big crowds around the crap tables. The place was full of noise and drunken shouting. A bony, middle-aged hoodlum wearing a Harley-Davidson t-shirt boomed up to the bar and yelled, "Goddamn, what day is this? Saturday?" "More like Sunday," somebody replied. "Ha, that's a bitch, ain't it?" The HD boomer shouted to nobody in particular. "Last night I was out home in Long Beach and somebody said they were running the Mint 400 today, so I says to my old lady, 'Man, I'm going.' He laughed, so she gives me a lot of crap about it, you know? So I started slapping her around, and the next thing I knew, two guys I never seen before got me out on the sidewalk working me over. Jesus, they beat me stupid." He laughed again, talking into the crowd and not seeming to care who listened. "Hell yes," he continued. Then one of them says, "Where are you going?" And I says, "Las Vegas to the Mint 400. So they gave me $10 and drove me down to the bus station. He paused. At least I think it was them. "Well, anyway, here I am. And I tell you, that was one hell of a long night, man. 7 hours on that goddamn bus. But when I woke up, it was dawn and here I was in downtown Vegas. And for a minute, I didn't know what the hell I was doing here. All I could think was, 'Oh, Jesus, here we go again. Who's divorced me this time?'" He accepted a cigarette from somebody in the crowd, still grinning as he lit it up. "But then I remembered, by God, I was here for the Mint 400. And man, that's all I needed to know. I tell you, it's wonderful to be here, man. I don't give a damn who wins or loses. It's just wonderful to be here with you people." Nobody argued with him. We all understood. In some circles, the Mint 400 is a far, far better thing than the Super Bowl, the Kentucky Derby, and the Lower Oakland Roller Derby Finals all rolled into one. This race attracts a very special breed, and our man in the Harley t-shirt was clearly one of them. The correspondent from Life nodded sympathetically and screamed at the bartender, "Sends him in what he needs." "Fast up with it," I croaked. "Why not 5? I smacked the bar with my open, bleeding palm. "Hell yes, bring us 10. "I'll back it," the life man screamed. He was losing his grip on the bar, sinking slowly to his knees, but still speaking with definite authority. "This is a magic moment in sport. It may never come again." Then his voice seemed to break. "I once did the Triple Crown," he muttered, "but it was nothing like this." The frog-eyed woman clawed feverishly at his belt. "Stand up," she pleaded. "Please stand up. You'd be a very handsome man if you'd just stand up." He laughed distractedly. "Listen, madam," he snapped. "I'm damn near intolerably handsome down here where I am. You'd go crazy if I stood up." The woman kept pulling at him. She'd been mooning at his elbows for 2 hours, and now she was making her move. The man from Life wanted no part of it. He slumped deeper into his crouch. I turned away. It was too horrible. We were, after all, the absolute cream of the national sporting press. And we were gathered here in Las Vegas for a very special assignment, to cover the 4th annual Mint 400. And when it comes to things like this, you don't fool around. But now, even before the spectacle got underway, there were signs that we might be losing control of the situation. Here we were on this fine Nevada morning, this cool, bright dawn in the desert, hunkered down at some greasy bar in a concrete blockhouse and gambling casino near the Mint Gun Club, about 10 miles out of Vegas. And with the race about to start, we were dangerously disorganized. Outside, the lunatics were playing with their motorcycles, taping the headlights, topping off oil in their forks, last-minute bolt tightening, carburetor screws, manifold nuts, etc. And the first 10 bikes blasted off on the stroke of 9. It was extremely exciting, and we all went outside to watch. The flag went down, and these 10 poor buggers popped their clutches and zoomed into the first turn, all together. Then somebody grabbed the lead, a 405 Husqvarna, as I recall, and a cheer went up as the rider screwed it on and disappeared in a cloud of dust. "Well, that's that," somebody said. "They'll be back around in an hour or so. Let's go back to the bar." But not yet, no. There were something like 190 more bikes waiting to start. They went off 10 at a time, every 2 minutes. At first, it was possible to watch them out to a distance of some 200 yards from the starting line, but this visibility didn't last long. The third brace of 10 disappeared into the dust about 100 yards from where we stood. And by the time they'd sent off the first 100, with us still another 100 to go, our visibility was down to something like 50 feet. We could see as far as the hay bales at the end of the pits. Beyond that point, the incredible dust cloud that would hang over this part of the desert for the next 2 days was already formed up solid. None of us realized at the time that this was the last we would see of the fabulous Mint 400. By noon, it was hard to see the pit area from the bar casino, 100 feet away in the blazing sun. The idea of trying to cover this race in any conventional press sense was absurd. It was like trying to keep track of a swimming meet in an Olympic-sized pool filled with talcum powder instead of water. The Ford Motor Company had come through, though, as promised, with a press bronco and a driver. But after a few savage runs across the desert, looking for motorcycles and occasionally finding one, I abandoned this vehicle to the photographers and went back to the bar. It was time, I felt, for an agonizing reappraisal of the whole scene. The race was definitely underway. I had witnessed the start. I was sure of that much. But what now? Rent a helicopter? Get back in that stinking bronco? Wander out on the goddamn desert and watch these fools race past the checkpoints, one every 13 minutes. By 10, they were spread out all over the course. It was no longer a race. Now it was an endurance contest. The only visible action was at the start-finish line, where every few minutes some geek would come speeding out of the dust cloud and stagger off his bike while his pit crew would gas it up, then launch it back onto the track with a fresh driver for another 50-mile lap, another brutal hour of kidney-killing madness out there in that terrible, dust-blind limbo. Somewhere around 11, I made another tour in the press vehicle, but all we found were two dune buggies full of what looked like retired petty officers from San Diego. They cut us off in a dry wash and demanded, "Where is the damn thing?" "Beats me," I said. "We're just good patriotic Americans like yourselves." Both of their buggies were covered with ominous symbols, screaming eagles carrying American flags in their claws, a slant-eyed snake being chopped to bits by a buzzsaw made of stars and stripes. And one of the vehicles had what looked like a machine gun mount on the passenger side. They were having a bang-up time, just crashing around the desert at top speed and hassling anybody they met. "What outfit you fellas with?" one of them shouted. The engines were all roaring. We could barely hear each other. "The sporting press," I yelled. "We're friendlies, hired geeks." Dim smiles. "If you want a good chase," I shouted, "you should get after that skunk from CBS News up ahead in the big black Jeep. He's the man responsible for the selling of the Pentagon." "Hot damn," two of them screamed at once. "A black Jeep, you say?" They roared off, and so did we, bouncing across the rocks and scrub oak slash cactus like iron tumbleweeds. The beer in my hand flew up and hit the top, then fell in my lap and soaked my crotch with warm foam. "You're fired," I said to the driver. "Take me back to the pits." It was time, I felt, to get grounded, to ponder this rotten assignment and figure out how to cope with it. Lacerda insisted on total coverage. He wanted to go back out in the dust storm and keep trying for some rare combination of film and lens that might penetrate the awful stuff. Joe, our driver, was willing. His name was not really Joe, but that's what we had been instructed to call him. I had talked to the FOMOCO boss the night before, and when he mentioned the driver was he was assigning to us, he said, "His real name is Steve, but you should call him Joe." "Why not?" I said. "We'll call him anything he wants. How about Zoom?" "No dice," said the Ford man. "It has to be Joe." Lacerda agreed, and sometime around noon, he went out on the desert again in the company of our driver, Joe. I went back to the blockhouse bar slash casino that was actually the Mint Gun Club, where I began to drink heavily, think heavily, and make many heavy notes.